Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
My name is Bruce Boyd, and I am a managing director at Arabella and an original Arabellan. Today, I am speaking with Edgar Villanueva. Edgar has been a leading voice in what he calls decolonizing wealth. In other words, how do we make philanthropy more equitable? There is no more important a topic. Edgar is a colleague and a friend whose thoughts on this important topic I find both provocative and inspiring. Edgar and I spoke by Zoom. Please enjoy our conversation. Edgar, my friend, it is so good to see you again. So I really, really appreciate your taking the time to join the Arabella podcast series. I have to say, I've always found our conversations both provocative and inspiring. And, you know, that's an important combination. And I've always been grateful for the spirit that you bring to these conversations. So thank you. And thank you again for being with us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, listen, before we dig in, let me briefly introduce you to our listeners who may not be familiar with your story. You are a very interesting and a very complicated guy. So you are Native American. You're from the South. You're the son of a domestic worker. And, oh, by the way, you're a philanthropist and an artist, author, the senior vice president at the Schott Foundation, on the board of a family foundation, a leader with North Americans in Philanthropy, and the author of Decolonizing Wealth. So I gotta believe that this journey has been even a little bit surprising to you. And I'm curious, as you think about that journey, you know, what has been some of the critical inflection points? Reflect a bit on how you came from North Carolina to the place that you are today.
Sure. Yeah. What a who will play me in this movie, Bruce?
Because no, not me. That's for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's I have had a tremendous, rewarding career working in philanthropy, and I really love this sector. Some see me as a critic, and I do have a lot of critiques, but this work is afforded me an awesome journey. When I first got into philanthropy 16 years ago now, that was definitely a reflection point, because when I got into this sector, we were a lot less diverse than we are now. We absolutely had a very few Native Americans working in the field. And I was actually quite young too, which I was 28 at the time. And, you know, for a large private foundation, you didn't see a lot of folks around coming out of grad school. I had some work experience, but I was relatively young to be in my role. So yeah, I got into philanthropy at a young age. I was at a health foundation that worked across the state of North Carolina. And, you know, I fell in love with the craft of grant making, you know, the magic that you can see when you move the right resources and, you know, to the right people at the right time, and being able to kind of imagine that and to be a part of orchestrating that became kind of addictive to me. I was like, this is really amazing. What I increasingly saw, though, as I did this work, is that the resources often were not going to people from my community and to communities of color. I worked at a foundation that had a mission of prioritizing low-income communities. And many of our grantees absolutely focused on those communities. But there were a lot of folks who were, you know, institutions that I would not think of as low-wealth institutions. We funded a lot of, you know, big universities and academic medical centers and those kinds of groups, which is just fine. But we did not fund a lot of small community-based organizations, and absolutely did not fund a lot of BIPOC-led organizations. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, there was a moment in time where I realized, wow, this is like a sensitive issue, because to me, I thought I was just doing my job, right? Of like finding, going into the community, finding those organizations doing that work. And I began to notice as I tried to bring in new organizations and ask questions about why aren't we supporting these organizations? I see the impact of their work. And that began to be sort of a question that was sort of threatening in some ways. And I began to be seen as an outlier or a person who was trying to rock the boat. I always talk about this time where I was in a board meeting and I was really kind of hearing a no when I wanted to hear a yes. I was advocating for this funding to go to a particular group. And I just didn't understand why I couldn't make the case. And there was a moment where the leadership of the organization kind of called me out in front of the room and in front of the entire board and said, you know, Edgar, you're getting too big for your britches. And this was a very like sad moment. I was completely deflated. And I began to feel like, you know, wow, this is a point in time where I feel like I'm standing out on an island trying to do the right thing. And why is this not reconciling with what everyone else is trying to accomplish here? And it made me understand that there was sort of subjects at the time that were almost taboo to ask. And there was an expectation that was to, you know, follow the status quo and kind of keep my head down. And I realized that I was hired for my lived experience and for all of these identities that I represent, but I was expected to kind of leave them at the door and not bring that. When I later in my career, I ended up in Seattle working at a foundation that was much more progressive and used, you know, the right language. And I moved all the way to Seattle because I wanted this opportunity to work in a grant making institution that was far more progressive and very diverse, very unapologetic about funding in communities of color. And even there where I thought we would be free from some of these dynamics, there were still certain dynamics in place around power and who got to decide and how decisions were made. And I remember, again, I was in a situation where I was sort of advocating for a certain decision or for funding to go to a certain place. And, you know, I wasn't like this super radical person, right? Like, let's be clear. I wasn't running into the boardroom, fist in the air, you know, power to the people or wearing, you know, regalia or anything like that. I was really, you know, effectively managing up, I thought. And there was pressure to not ask questions and to, you know, if you ask questions or pushed, it was seen as like threatening in some way. And I remember there, even in that space, I was asked a question by the leadership, which side are you on? Are you on their side or do you work for us? And I was perplexed by that. I was like, why do I have to choose a side? I am from the community of the community, and we should be as a foundation. And so that began my journey of really wanting to explore some of these underlying tensions and some of these pillars of white supremacy that are embedded in our work that people have been afraid to address for whatever reasons. Because I know that as a sector, we really do care about diversity, equity, and inclusion. I do believe that we're sincere about wanting to be equitable, but there are things that are baked into our sector that I think have been real barriers and challenges for us. And so here we are.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, you know, we have made progress. I agree with you. And that's thanks to people like you. And we'll dig into decolonizing wealth, as you call it, and, you know, both some of the progress we've made, but of course, many of the hurdles that still remain. So, you know, before we get to that, though, you know, you've been pushing against the status quo, and that's been tough. And I know at the same time, as a philanthropist, there's been some sort of internal dissonance or conflict, even for you playing that role, given your background and the communities about which you deeply care. And you've said something that's just really interesting to me that I'd love for you to just say a word or two about. And that is that you have said, quote, "Money is the medicine that chose me," close quote. And I know that's been an important realization for you, and say a little bit about how that came to pass and what that realization has meant for you.
After my second job in philanthropy, I began to feel honestly a little disillusioned about this sector, you know, and questioning my own place in it. I knew that I had been a thought leader and had done some really fantastic work. But at a certain point in time, I just began to question, you know, if this was the place for me, because it felt like we weren't getting to a place of being in authentic relationship with communities in the way that I needed to feel so the resources could really flow. And I went to North Carolina and had this conversation with an elder of mine. And I told her, I said, you know, I'm feeling that like I'm not sure I'm in the right place. Maybe philanthropy is not where I need to be. It's sort of an uphill battle in some ways. Like I've had great experiences and there are lots of perks to working in philanthropy. But at the same time, I really want to be in a place where I'm doing the most for my community. And I am having a hard time being in this bridge position where I have one foot in community and another foot inside this super privileged place where I'm always having to code switch back and forth and translate and sort of monitor how much I push all the time and just always organizing internally to make a difference. And it can be exhausting, especially for people of color. And in having that conversation with my elder, she said to me, Edgar, the medicine that has chosen you is money. And that sent me on a wild goose chase of trying to figure out what that meant. Because in our culture, you know, anything can be medicine that is something that we esteem to be sacred or have a life-giving force or to bring a sense of balance to our lives. And we all have it. And, you know, you can all think about it for a second in terms of what your medicine might be. Sometimes it's just having a quiet cup of coffee in the morning to get your head on straight before you start your day. It can show up in all kinds of ways. And we believe that you don't choose the medicine, the medicine chooses you. And so to have this elder to say, Edgar, money has chosen you, I really struggled with that because I grew up, as you said, Bruce, in the South, and I grew up in the church. And I remember there was this negative connotation often about money, that money was seen as something that was dirty and evil and the root of all evil. And so I had to explore that and try to reconcile it. And that really brought about this idea that is really the heart of the work that I do with decolonizing wealth. And that is understanding that it's really not about the money. It's about us. It's about us as human beings who have historically used money in a way that has harmed communities and people and the planet. We have esteemed money more than we have people, and the proximity to the power and privilege that money brings is just something that we, I think, in philanthropy at times have been more into than we have been into the change in the money can make in communities. So I have carried that idea like, wow, if money is medicine, how do I use money for a sacred purpose? And it's quite simple. If we use money to help restore balance, we use money to help heal and repair and to bring about relationship versus separation and division, then money actually can be a tool. Anything can be a tool that can be used to harm, but it also can be something that brings about healing. Water can be a tool, right? You think about in indigenous communities and Standing Rock and how we have fought in different ways to protect water, because water is a life-giving resource, right? It's very sacred. But at the same time, water can be used as bullets and that are fired on protesters, right? And so anything can hurt and harm depending on how we use it and how we allow it to be used to be medicine.
Yeah. Edgar, that's such a powerful story. And I think obviously powerful for you personally, but also I think for others of us who've sometimes struggled as philanthropists, just a really sort of helpful perspective. So thank you for that. Now, you've begun to hint at what you mean by decolonizing wealth, which, of course, is the title of your book. Super powerful. If listeners, if you haven't read it, you should. But say a little bit more when you say decolonizing wealth, what do you mean by that? And then, you know, we'll dig into some very specific things that might be done to truly decolonize wealth. But say a little bit about what you mean when you use that term.
Absolutely. So decolonizing is becoming a very popular word. We are decolonizing our diets. We're decolonizing fitness, decolonizing education. It's a word that is becoming more and more a lens to problem solve and to address different issues in our lives. So it can take on different meanings. For me, when I think about decolonization, I like to start with first explaining what colonization is, because we often have a incorrect or romanticized idea of what colonization is, right? In the U.S. context, we are taught as children that this very romantic story of Christopher Columbus and, you know, the different conquistadors who came, and then the gold rush and, you know, Western, you know, expansion and all of these things. I remember as a kid sounded
turkey at Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. And they kind of, you know, it was kind of exciting to read these things as a kid and to think about, you know, the explorers. And so we're not taught the accurate history. And of course, we deify some of these folks who were leaders of that. You know, I read the other day that kind of just speaks to this point that as children, we are taught to learn the names of the three ships of Christopher Columbus, right? But we are not taught the actual land that we're on. Those ships, many of them didn't even, I don't even remember my history if they actually touched the shores of this country, but we are not taught the land that we're on. So in current day, I know that not only are we not taught an accurate history about colonization, we are actively erasing that and rewriting that. In 27 states in America, Native Americans are not even mentioned in K-12 history curriculum, which is like this newer research that came out from Illuminative. And so there is an active erasure. So part of the work that I do is to actually help people understand how we got here. We have to be honest about the history of how we got here. And it's facts that we have to take ownership over. Colonization was a horrific, violent force. It was genocide. It was violence against bodies. It was the erasure of people, the attempted erasure of people. And the fact is, colonization is a force that is not just a historical thing. It's still going on around the world. It's still happening in the U.S., right? When we tear families apart, when we put children in cages, these are active acts of colonization that are still happening. And we are so numb to this. You know, it's all we've ever known. And I know, like many folks, I hear the stories, I see the news, and my stomach is completely upset. But it's not long before I settle into bed and go right to sleep while these things are happening, because it's just so the norm. Colonization has also, I call it the colonizer virus, has spread in different ways that are not so visible and so violent. The colonizer virus is in our systems and our policies and processes, and it's so baked in that we don't even understand that we are actually causing division and separation and oppression through these different mechanisms. When we look at public education, for example, that's an example that I use a lot, we see the colonizer virus at play. Who has good schools? Who doesn't have good schools? Throughout decades and generations of economic policies, we see that they have been intentionally privileging white folks and keeping poor people of color in poverty. And so this is what I mean by colonization. It is a force that exploits, that controls, that divides, that conquers, and commands. So to decolonize is to undo that. How do we do that?
Easier said than done, my friend.
How do we make it right? And, you know, decolonizing is, you know, taken literally means that land is returned that was stolen, you know, sovereignty not only over the land and resources, but over social structures and traditions. All of that is granted back to whom it was stolen. It means the autonomy of indigenous peoples must be reinstated. And when we think about decolonization as this political process, we can get stuck and make no headway. So the easy way for that I think about decolonization, and this is not in any way to water it down, I think of decolonization is actually a process of healing from the trauma of colonization. So if you understand that colonization has violated us and has left us traumatized, not just indigenous people, not just Black people, but all of us, whether you are descendants of colonizers or settlers, white people too, have been traumatized by colonization. We can't undo that, but what we can do is focus on how we stop the cycles of abuse and how we heal ourselves and how we expand possibilities for the future. So for me, decolonization is really almost synonymous with the idea of healing.
You know, I love that. And, you know, that's one of the things I appreciate about you so much is, you know, I think healing is something we can all relate to. So I'd love to get even more specific about how we heal. So as you know, I'm an old white guy. I've been on my own personal journey around allyship with people of color over the last 5 or 6 years. And something else you've said, and I've certainly found this, that we have to get comfortable with discomfort. And I have to say, you know, being in the middle of many of these conversations has been uncomfortable, frankly. But I think to your point, we need to accept that and work through that. So what handful of things, because a number of the people who are listening to this are philanthropists, and of course, many of them, maybe most of them, certainly most of them are white. So what would you say to the white philanthropist who wants to make progress towards healing, addressing colonization, decolonizing? You know, what are the handful of things that you would suggest a white philanthropist do to promote healing?
You know, the first thing that I would say to create some context is to understand that when you are beginning a journey of healing, it's not a journey that's always focused on positioning you to be a better ally or to support some poor Black and Indigenous folks over there, right? It is really about understanding that to engage in a journey of racial healing is really about your own liberation, and to know that it's going to be uncomfortable, that you have to go into a dark place before you get to the other side. But on that other side, the joy and peace and liberation that it will bring actually to you as a white person is worth the journey. And I can't tell you how many white folks have told me, you know, Edgar, I read this book, or I engaged in this conversation, or you know, joined this group or that, began doing this work, and how it has brought them closer to their own family members. Because there's something about colonization that we've all internalized in a certain way, where we build walls and we become isolated from one another. And we, you know, subscribe to ideas of individualism versus the collective. And that's even more pervasive in white communities who don't perhaps have the same type of cultural, you know, practices that we do in my community. And so we need to tear those walls down and embrace our humanity and embrace our innate need and desire to be dependent on others. And so that's the exciting part that I want to lay out for folks to say, hey, jump into this. It's going to be bumpy for a while, but you're going to get to a place of freedom that's going to make it worth the ride. You know, there are a couple of things that I'll highlight in the work of decolonizing wealth. We talk about a seven steps of healing, and we won't go through all of them. But we invite you to read, to think about a process for incorporating these into your life. They are based off a process of truth and reconciliation, and also a process of restorative justice, if that's a term that may be familiar to folks. Those ideas all come from Indigenous wisdom and practices. And so initially what happens on the front end of a journey is actually that darkness that I mentioned, or that heaviness or that discomfort that you mentioned, Bruce, is because we're going to feel grief. You know, we have to grieve when we begin to acknowledge the pain that's been caused by the accumulation of wealth in the first place. And when we begin to acknowledge the origins of wealth, and maybe even in someone's family that's listening to this, to acknowledge that people of color, Indigenous folks, low-wage workers, many folks may have been exploited in the process of accumulating wealth that your family is benefiting from at the moment. And, you know, this is not being said to pose guilt on folks, because a lot of this happened before we were even born, right? You might have been just born into a family, but it's a reality that we have to grapple with. And so, you know, the first step is to actually understand the origins of wealth in your family and to grapple with the messiness of that privilege. If you don't know, ask questions. A lot of times we don't share these types of secrets within families, but you should actually know where money comes from and how the wealth got into your hands. That truth and that reality, although it may be painful, is really important for the rest of your journey. You can't repair something if we don't know what's wrong. You know, we can't make it right. So this is about restorative justice and healing. So we have to like diagnose the problem. So that's the first step that I think folks can take. The second thing I would say is, when you understand that folks may have been harmed along the way, we should apologize. We should think about the harm that wealth, money, has potentially caused, or maybe an institution that you're leading, maybe it's something within your family. But we should think about how we actually can apologize to folks who have been harmed along the way. That can show up in all kinds of ways. I'm really inspired right now the way that I see people apologizing. And this may feel surface to talk about it so briefly. It really is a profound, deep experience that we don't have time to fully unpack. But, you know, I'm thinking recently of like the LA Times newspaper, the owner apologizing for the historical role that that newspaper has played in perpetuating racism, right? And saying, you know what, this is a fact of what has happened, and we are sorry. We're taking ownership for that, and we are making these commitments to go forward. We cannot change or heal or repair anything if we're not truly sorry. So after we know the truth, we should feel a sense of wanting to apologize for, you know, the way that we have potentially harmed communities. And then the last thing I'll say, because I won't go through all the steps, is like, what's the plan to use your wealth as medicine? What's the plan to repair? We know that the communities that need to be prioritized in that process are obviously communities of color. So look at your own giving. How are you prioritizing Black and Indigenous communities in your portfolio? Those are the communities historically who have been marginalized from the opportunities to build wealth. Those are the communities that have built wealth in this country, and have not been able to benefit from the bounty of that wealth because of, you know, white supremacy. And so there's a way to think about reparations in your giving. What would that look like? And there's so many great resources. I wish we had time to unpack, but those will be three activities that, you know, I would invite anyone to engage in thinking about healing in their giving.
You know, Edgar, super helpful. And, you know, I would build upon your last point by saying that it is important, of course, sort of what you support. So supporting communities of color, for instance. But this is something I think that's often overlooked and also important. It's how you support them. So coming to those conversations with humility, with a listening posture, devolving decision-making, you know, all of those elements of the how, which are not typically practiced by the traditional philanthropist, I think are also very, very important. And that's certainly something that I've learned to be better at than certainly I was 5 years ago.
Absolutely.
So let me make just a bit of a pivot, since I know our time is almost up, and I want to make sure we reflect on this sort of last question. I mean, this has been a year for the history books, as you well know. I mean, in so many ways that are, frankly, not all that good. You know, racial strife, a pandemic. To the extent that there's good that comes out of this, it seems to me, it is a recognition by all of us, and of course it was obvious to many, but that there are just systemic inequities that we need to deal with as a country. So I'm curious, what impact do you think this year will have on decolonizing wealth? And where do you think will be in light of that in, say, 5 or 10 years? Are you optimistic, pessimistic? You know, what's your diagnosis? Looking into your crystal ball, you know, where do you think, what do you think we'll learn from this, and where do you think it'll take us?
I feel very optimistic. I think in this past year, if there is any silver lining, which feels kind of not a right thing to say, but I think the COVID pandemic, the economic fallout, the sort of heightened awareness of racial injustice in this country, in some ways pushed all of us to lean into our collective humanity in some way, our collective suffering. And of course, not everybody was impacted, but most people were, regardless of if you have privilege, if you have money. We all felt the pinch of this pandemic. And for me, at least in my lifetime, this was the closest to systems fail that I think I ever experienced, right? Where I actually didn't know if we were going to be okay a couple of times. It was really frightening. And in these times of crisis, it unfortunately took this, but I think it did sort of bring an awareness of our interdependency on each other. And even like when you think about COVID spreading, you know, I can do all the right things, but if someone else is not wearing a mask or practicing social distancing, I can still get sick. And so we need each other in order to get out of this mess. And it's that's an indigenous value of all my relations and interdependency that really drives a lot of how we do our work and how we do our giving and just our worldview of life that I think impacted philanthropy in a lot of ways. We saw over the past 6 months, foundations kind of putting aside all the process or loopholes or, you know, the things that have been in place, you know, logic models to move money quickly to respond to the pandemic. We saw folks stepping up in new ways to support the movement for Black lives, to support Native communities around COVID response. I think we're in a new place. The past 2 to 3 years, we've been doing a lot of self-reflection and philanthropy. Our work with Decolonizing Wealth contributed to that. There's other work, you know, Anand's book, Winners Take All. There was a lot of critique and a lot of questioning around our relevance and what we're doing wrong or what we must do better. Even before 2020, I felt there was like an awakening and awareness and a lot of grappling and coming to terms with how we have not done enough. And the fact that only 8 to 10% of grant dollars go to communities of color is like an injustice. Like we have failed. And so that, I believe, has, you know, stirred us and got us ready to respond quickly in this moment. We didn't have to make the case for Black lives for much of philanthropy. And of course, you know, I am making generalizations here because everyone didn't come to the party. But in general, we saw a response like we've never seen. I know that we are talking about issues of power, issues of white supremacy. This type of language and conversation is very new to philanthropy, but it is the conversation that folks are having right now. And I think that openness is quite sincere, and people are really wanting to understand what our role is as donors, as philanthropists, is going forward to help bring our country back together and to support racial healing, because we're all tired of this mess, regardless of where you sit politically. Like, I don't think we want to fight anymore. We got to find a way to come together and be a better country. So I'm very optimistic. There are so many examples that I could share of foundations who have not been showing up in the space, who are now really doing the work and are moving dollars. And I have a fund called Liberated Capital where many foundations have come to us. And I've heard folks even say to me, you know, we don't know how to get it right. We don't have time for us to become experts at this thing. We just want to trust you to move this capital for us, right? Which is an example of awareness, right? And, you know, a change from that diagram of we need to be experts, we need to research this over and over again, we need to put out reports before we act. We have to act now in this sector. And so I do feel inspired. The verdict is out, right, to see if we move on. I think that we sometimes do like the sugar high in philanthropy of, you know, kind of responding in the moment to whatever thing, and we quickly forget and move on. But I'm convinced that there is a large you know, swath of our sector that is not going to go back to how things were, that we're in a new place in our work, and that excites me.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, I certainly hope that's true. I will say I'm glad to hear that you are inspired, because I come to this, I think, as one part cynic and one part optimist. But I do think there is a possibility that this is a transformative moment for philanthropy. And we're certainly seeing that across our clients, which are big, small, and across the country. So I think that's encouraging. And I will say, and maybe we'll close with this, I'll leave you with the last word, but you know, I love the two words that you use that we hope we carry with us after this, and that is healing and humanity. And if those are the two words that are our touchstone coming out of 2020, I might even share your optimism.
You know, I feel like we have to be hopeful. I know that I am a person that has grown a lot, honestly, and I believe that people can change, and I have a lot of faith in humanity. So that's my default position is that we are going to grow and do better. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
Edgar, thanks again. I found this conversation, like I have every conversation we've had, both provocative and inspiring. So thank you for that. And I think it's important for folks to know where they can go to learn more about your work. So where are a couple of places where they can find more about all the good work you're doing?
Absolutely. Our website is decolonizingwealth.com. For folks who have read Decolonizing Wealth, the book, we would love to share that in December, we have a new journal coming out, a journal for reflection and action for those of you who want to take a deeper dive into the healing process. And so we invite you to check that out. That will be available on our website starting December 1st.
Excellent. So I encourage everyone to take a look. Thanks again, Edgar.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.